This is file 76. This is August 5th, 2014. This is Jean McMillan. I'm interviewing Dan Dwyer about his life and times in Salisbury and the history of the Housatonic Bookshop through Lion's Head Books, through Johnny Cake Books, and anything else that takes his fancy. And we'll start with, what is your name?
My name is Dan Dwyer.
And when were you born?
I was born on August 24th, 1952, in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
And your parents' names?
My mother's name is Annette Lillian Charest. My father was...
I'm going to have to ask you to spell that. I got the Annette. Lily?
No, Lillian. L-I-L-L-I-A-N-E.
And maiden name?
Charest. C-H-A-R-E-S-T.
And your dad?
And my father's name was Daniel Dwyer. Daniel Francis Dwyer. I being a junior, but I never used it since he died.
And when I type this, I need to make sure I have everything spelled correctly.
Right.
And do you have siblings?
I have a sister Louise and a sister Anne.
Anne with an E?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Educational background?
I graduated from Georgetown University in 1974.
Now, I know that you came to the area looking for a second home to get away from Manhattan. Tell me about Bunker Hill and the Ericksons, please.
Well, when my partner, now my husband Jim Montanari, and I were living in New York, we searched in the two-hour radius of Manhattan for a place to have a weekend place, we both being natives in New England, and we ended up looking in Salisbury because it was the most affordable and the most accessible and the best place, the prettiest place from Manhattan. And we ended up buying a small parcel of land on Bunker Hill Road that had resulted in two small house subdivisions and a water tower. The land was basically, I think, maybe a 10-acre parcel just at the foot of Bunker Hill where Bunker Hill forks from Mount Riga. And as you head up on the right, there was a nice meadow with a woodland patch in the back of it. The woodland patch became the water tower for the Bridgeport Hydraulic Company, and the upper parcel was already developed with a house owned by the Lampsons, who had Reggie, who had grown up right there, just below Bunker Hill. In any event, we bought what was the meadow part, the lower meadow part of this. It was about a 3.5. How was it? Two to three acre parcel. And all of that land, the point of this story being, was owned by by the Ericksons, who famously owned the farm at the top of Bunker Hill before it takes the hook up to Lion's Head, and for years ran the what we call the town dump.
Right.
So the Ericksons had this parcel land. They sold some of it to the Bridgeport Hydraulic, and Dan Dwyer and Jim Montanari, native New Englanders but from Manhattan, built a little Trelleborg house tucked back in the meadow.
Tell me about Harold and the Dowsing
Sticks. Well, so Harold, we had a fellow named the Trelleborg actually dotted the landscape around here in the early, in the mid-80s. Skip McMillan, who grew up in town, was a very resourceful and practical researcher of all kinds of things, and he had discovered this this housing system, which was a very efficient system developed by the Danes during the energy crisis in the 1970s. In any event, he built the first Trelleborg house here in Salisbury, and he was a great advocate of it, and it was a very, very affordable way to build a house. So Jim and I did too, and also the Gallups built one at the same time. Who is the former funeral director?
Newkirk?
No, not Newkirk. Right here in Gomez.
Gomez.
Gomez built one. And then there were about 10 others, maybe about 8 others, probably a dozen around the area. In any event, ours was the second or the third to be constructed. Dick Fitzgerald built one as well. In any event, so we had Mike Minnick, who grew up in town as well, graduated from Salisbury School. He was a friend of Skip's, and Mike was our general, well, not our general contractor, but he was our contractor on site who managed everything for us. And he, of course, was knew the Ericksons very well, and he and his wife Mary at the time were renting one of the small houses that Harold Erickson owned up near Lion's Head. In any event, so Mike would confer with, not Harold, who was his brother?
Walter.
Walter. Who is the white-collar brother?
That was Walter.
Walter, okay. Mike rented from Walter, but he would consult with Harold about matters to do with the land and getting things done locally. So when we needed a well, as you need
yes,
for a house,
yes.
Mike called Harold to come down and douse. And Harold came down and he, you know, I think he insisted it had to be a cherry.
Yes.
A cherry, what do you call it?
A fork.
Fork. Mm-hmm. So he got his cherry fork and we observed him and the thing started twanging around some part of the ground. And then we called Walter Allen, who drilled most of the wells in these here parts. And he came over and drilled a well and God damn it, it worked like a real well, yeah. So that was kind of interesting to see, as two kids who came out of New York to see how things really get doused and things really get dug and things really flow forth. The other Harold story that was really great, it was in the cold of winter. And I think when they had put in the foundation and they had buried all the lines to service the house, electrical and otherwise, they forgot the cable, and I don't know, we needed to get the cable TV in, and it was really cold, and somebody was bringing a sledgehammer by and to break the soil, to dig the line. But there was some occasion where Harold came down to confer with Mike, and he had these, I think, you know, he had an upper palate that was missing a couple of teeth anyway, and he was a real, you know, salt of the earth kind of guy, and had these big gnarly hands, and one of his his right hand was completely slashed in the fleshy part of the thumb and the hand. And when you looked at the incision or the cut that was made, it was all sewn up. And I said, Harold, what the hell did you do with your hand? And he said, oh, I cut it. I said, well, did you go to the hospital? He said, no. And he showed me, and I looked carefully, and he had really stitched up his hand with twine. Not nylon.
Not fishing line. Not
kitchen,
parcel twine.
Kitchen twine. And there it was. And
New Englanders are tough, aren't they?
Yes, they were. So those are my two stories of building a modern Danish, ever-tasteful house in the back of a meadow in the foothills of Mount Riga.
And how long did you live in that house?
From 85 through, I guess, 1989.
And then you went down to Salmon Kill Farm.
To Salmon Kill Road.
Okay.
Salmon Kill Farm is the big farm that's best noted for the brick house.
Well, I want the history
across,
on that.
Across the bridge. The house that we bought had been owned by Jeannie Chester. And Jeannie Chester was beloved by many people in town. She died in 1988 or 1989. So her house was for sale. The house, as the story goes, was a tenant house. It's a real old farmhouse. It was built between 1795 and 1805, and it's a classic center chimney, post and beam, plain vanilla,
mm-hmm.
A New England farmhouse. And she bought it in the late 1940s. The Tilts, Bert and Mary Tilt, Albert Tilt and Mary Tilt. Mary was Jeannie Chester's sister. And their father was, I think, the chairman of General Foods during most of the 20s and 30s. And the family lived in this grand old estate in Greenwich. When Mr. Chester died, they broke up that estate, which was the reason for Mary and Bert to come looking for a big kind of estate-like farm in New England. So they found Salmon Kill Farm. Jeannie Chester had polio, and she came up and she discovered this little farmhouse. And the way the story goes, went to them and said, I'm so, you know, glad that you're going to buy the farm, but there's a little farmhouse up the road. I'd like to buy that. I'd like to live in that and buy that from you. So they took that farmhouse and they split it off on a couple of acres and they sold it to her. And she was the one in the late 40s, 1950s, who restored it. It had been a working farmhouse through most of the 19th century. For most of the 20th century, it was sort of the, you know, the forgotten other house owned by Salmon Kill Farm, and it was, you know, lived in variously by different people who remain unidentified, except it was rented some of the summers to family members. Before the Tilts owned Salmon Kill Farm, it was owned by the Peels. And the Peels have two claims to fame, one on Peels beer on one side, and that fortune also, I guess it was on the same side, that fortune also resulted in one of them founding the Scientific American. In any event, I here operate Johnny Cake Books in the village of Salisbury, and one day Jonathan Peels came in, and we started talking about one thing or another, and I didn't know who he was, and he said, "Where do you live?" And I said, "Salmon Kill Road." And he said, "Oh, I know that." And I said, and he said, "What house?" And I described it, and he said, "Well, my grandparents used to own Salmon Kill Farm." I said, "Oh, yes, I knew that." He said, "But my parents rented the house that you live in when I was a youth. And we used to summer there." So he said, "I remember that house." So I said, "Well, you've got to come and visit." So a couple of months later, he and his wife, Madeline, they both live in New York, and I think they have a summer place or a weekend place someplace in the Hudson Valley. In any event, they came to visit, and they were keenly interested, particularly he, obviously, in the house. And he walked around, and he sort of, you know, became very contemplative and was remembering everything. And he said, it being a center chimney structure, you know, looked at the big fireplace, which was originally the kitchen. He said, "Oh, yes, I remember this room, but we used to have a pot-bellied stove in the fireplace." And then he looked out a window and he said, "But this window wasn't here. This was a doorway, and we used to use this as the front door, and people used to just come up the little gravel driveway and park their car here. And now, of course, we have a lawn and a stone wall, and formerly used the front door, and of course the kitchen door in the back." And then he looked across the land, which is a small piece of land. There's a patch of lawn, there's a patch, small patch of meadow, and then it gets densely wooded. And from the house you can see a small pond. And he said, "Well, there's another pond down there." And I said, "Well, yes, there is." And there was a stream-fed pond. So actually a typical, you know, hillside, mountainside mm-hmm. stream, now densely yep. Yep. densely shaded with hemlocks and all the rest. And he said, "Yeah, of course, you know, when we rented this place, it was in the 1940s. And he said, "I couldn't have been more than 6, 7, or 8 years old. And this was all just plain open field, because all of it had been, you know, as we all know from Salisbury, all of the lands had been, or most of the lands had been felled in the 19th century, or then farmed. So a lot of the growth that we now regard as mature is really new growth.
Yeah, it
and
is.
A lot of it just wasn't there in the 1930s or 40s. So he said, "This was all open, but there was a stream down there." So I said, let's go see it. So we started walking across the little lawn, and then we got across the little meadow, and then we started walking into the woods a little bit. And he just sort of fell into a trance, and he started reciting Shakespeare. And I like to respect people's memory, so I sort of dropped my distance from him and let him, you know, take the lead. And he found his way to a rock, large rock, in the stream that feeds the stream-fed pond. And he said, and he was continuing in and out of this Shakespeare kind of soliloquy all the while. And he said, "That's the rock." He said, "That's the rock that my mother sat on and read me Hamlet." And he had been reciting a soliloquy from Hamlet. And so I just stood there mesmerized and let him just...
go with it.
Yeah, just to sort of float in this reverie. And it was a really kind of magical moment, clearly for him. And clearly for me, I had never been time transported by virtue of somebody else's memory like that in my life, and I can't imagine what was going through his mind. But, I mean, there you go. That was probably of all the charms and the joys and the other things I've learned about the history of the house and the valley. I think that moment, observing somebody else who could recreate in such a real and vivid way for me, is my most vivid memory of, and will remain my most vivid memory of living in that house. Long
it
after
would, it would
yeah.
be.
Yeah.
I mean, it was such an unusual experience
yeah.
that few people have that opportunity.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely incredible.
So it's a, you know, it's a reminder of a lot of things. It's a reminder of how all of these places and structures have memories that went before us mm-hmm. and hopefully will continue after us.
That's the point of doing the oral history.
Well, that's it. So that's one of my favorite stories of, certainly my favorite story of the house on Sandlin Kill Road, and one of my favorite stories of living in Salisbury.
And it's a wonderful story, and thank you for sharing
that. Oh, you're welcome.
Now, let's do some work on the bookshop.
Mm.
I'm going to ask you to give a little information on Morris Ferrewski and his bookshop, and then bring it forward to your bookshop, please.
Well, Morris Ferrewski is legendary, not only in terms of the time that he spent living in Salisbury, married to one of the Scoville women, and running Housatonic Bookshop, which is now the site of Elise Harney's real estate, right across from the side entrance to the right across from the tavern entrance to the White Hart. But also, he's legendary for the history of rare books in the United States. He operated in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He operated in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Dunster House, and his stories are, you know, depending on who, yes, different stories about why he had to leave Cambridge. But anyway, mm-hmm. he set up shop here in Housatonic, and he really was, if you wanted to write a movie screenplay of the old-fashioned bookseller with the fireplace and the antique house and the antique books mm-hmm. sitting ruminating about all things philosophical.
Oh, he's a natural.
Historical, and then also having a colorful personality that spawned all kind of speculation about his private life and history and all of that. It would be he. In any event, his bookshop was renowned to anyone in the rare book business, and also to English people who would come and hunt for books in the United States. He was one of the first publishers of T.S. Eliot. He would have been, there's a famous story about how he could have been, would have been, except for the one-day drop in the U.S. mail system across the Atlantic at the time, the first publisher of T.S. Eliot in the United States. But he published some of his stuff anyway later. He was a close associate of Robert Frost mm-hmm. and really was a go-to book dealer for buying Robert Frost long before he became as popular and as such the icon that he now is. In any event, he operated Housatonic Bookshop beginning in 1932?
Yeah, I think 30, it's 30s.
30. Here. And apprenticing for him in the late, what was it would have been in the, certainly the late 60s and the early 70s, was Mike McCabe. Now, Mike is from a very, whom your oral history will tell you, and Salisbury history will tell you, the McCabe's figure prominently in Salisbury history. And Michael essentially apprenticed for him and went off eventually and started his own bookshop in the early 70s, which was called Lion's Head Books. And the structure in which we sit now, recording this interview, is Johnny Cake Books, formerly known as Lion's Head Books. But the structure used to sit, as we sit and look across the window, on the site where Le Bon's now is. And when the town elders, principally led by Curtis Rand's father, Jake Rand, mm-hmm. who was head of planning and zoning at the time, along with the Popes, along with the Ellsworths,
okay.
The Harrises too, I think, not sure about that elsewhere, certainly the Harris's, put together the Marketplace Association, which essentially owns the patch of land on which Le Bon's now sits, the parking lot and some of the attendant property to it. That went here instead of where now Lion's Head Books is. So the configuration, where and this went, I mean, I'm sorry, Lion's
the
Head.
The building was moved from where Le Bon's is now to here.
Yeah, but Le Bon's, the original plan for Le Bon's was to put it where now Lion's Head condominiums are.
Ah, okay.
And the town elders, in its wisdom,
said no,
and put it in back of Main Street instead of having a satellite shopping district outside of town, which really did change the nature of the town and prevented it from taking on that kind of semi-suburban appearance of a lot of other places. In any event, the structure in which Johnny Cake exists was an old cottage, an old house that sat where Le Bon's is. Jake Grant took it up, moved it here, plopped it down. Mike McCabe was the first renter of it, and in it set up Lion's Head Books. So we went from the Housatonic Bookshop in 1930 to Lion's Head Books in the 70s. And then Mike McCabe operated it through 2000. And in the spring of 2000, I had heard a rumor through town that Mike wanted to give up Lion's Head Books. Susan Rand owns the building, having been basically given the house and the property by her father-in-law, Jake Rand, as a wedding gift or an engagement gift back in the 70s. I called up Susan and said, I heard Mike is leaving. She said, yes. I said, I'll take it. So I took the rent over from Mike. I bought some of his inventory. He sold the rest of it off. And then I reconfigured the shop. And I opened in August. In fact, we're coming up on an anniversary. It was August.
Yes.
It was August 7th. 2000 is when I opened, and we're now August 5th, is it today? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's been 14 years since I've had the shop. So, to make this long story short, Salisbury has had an ongoing rare bookshop in its village since 1930, which for its size, which is something few places in the United States can say, but certainly I don't know of any other town with a population of 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 that has had an ongoing rare bookshop for now more than almost 80 years,
mm-hmm. which is quite an accolade.
I think it is historic. You know,
it is, and absolutely.
And the line of succession is quite clear.
And the quality has maintained superb all the way through.
You. Well, thank you.
Well, I mean that sincerely.
Well, thank you. So that's the story of Johnny Cake Books.
But you haven't told me about why you chose Johnny Cake Books.
Oh, Johnny Cake Books, yeah. That is a little bit of historic relevance, too. Mm-hmm. Now, oddly enough, this is a very esoteric connection between me, Johnny Cake Books, and Maurice Ferrusky and Housatonic Bookshop. Because if you go into Elise Harney, mm-hmm. real estate office, into the main office now, or in the main room and back of the front rooms, which are now her offices, there was the big fireplace, and over it still sits a relief? A wall relief of a whale, okay, that Maurice Ferrusky, I think, put there. That's a clue to the connection of why I call Johnny Cake Books Johnny Cake Books. I'm a native of New Bedford, Massachusetts, which is which historically is best known as the whaling capital mm-hmm. of America,
mm-hmm.
The richest per capita city in the world through the mid-19th century. All those whaling ships owned by all the good Quakers went out and got all this blubber that provided the lamp oil for millions or hundreds of thousands of households in the United States until whale oil and until oil and electricity and all the rest of it came along. Anyway, Johnny Cake Hill is the historic center of New Bedford. It's a little mound of a hilltop, sort of resembling, they called it Johnny Cake, I suspect, because it's a little mound of a hill, and a Johnny Cake is really a plop of
mm-hmm.
cornmeal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And atop Johnny Cake Hill in New Bedford, Massachusetts, sits the Whaling Museum, otherwise known as the Old Dartmouth Historical Society. Well, it was the Whaling Museum to which my parents would send me every rainy Saturday afternoon of my youth when I couldn't go to the park or outside to play. Because, goddammit, it's going to be good for you.
At some point it will be.
Well, here I am 50 years later, selling antique books. So, God damn it, they were right.
Isn't that distressing?
Yeah, yeah. And the other reason, so that's the personal allusion to Johnny Cake Hill or to Johnny Cake. The other allusion is literary, and since I opened my place called Johnny Cake Books, only one person out of hundreds has guessed it. And the literary allusion is, when you talk about whaling and whales, would be Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. And Johnny Cake Hill is actually the setting which Melville uses for his opening chapter, where Ishmael comes to town, finds victuals, finds lodging, gets up, worships at Seaman's Bethel on the Sunday morning, which is on the Sabbath, which is right across still from the entrance, or the old entrance now, of the Whaling Museum, right at the crest of Johnny Cake Hill, and then from whence he goes a-whaling. So it's a personal and a literary allusion.
And that is what makes it so special.
Well, it's one of the reasons.
Truly, it does make it special. And I am going on now to ask you about some of the other things that you've done of a civic nature.
Hmm. Well, let's see. Growing up in New Bedford, my parents were always civically involved. They, in terms of... my father was the Irish American Catholic funeral director, so he had a very prominent role in the community in New Bedford. They were very involved in church fairs. My mother was very involved in civic clubs and such. So... Being involved in public stuff has always, was the way I was brought up.
Sure.
And then I as a kid, a product of the 60s, when I came to maturity in the 60s, I got involved in politically. And my first job out of, when I graduated from Georgetown, I worked on Capitol Hill, and I met up with a group of young people. And to make a long story short, we all went off to work for Jimmy Carter. In 1976, and then I ended up doing press advance work for the Carter White House. And then I got involved, then I took a job with CBS, and that brought me to New York, and that brought me to, and my husband Jim, to come up here and to settle here.
Politically, what have you done in this town?
Well, then when I came up here, I sold real estate for a while. I was with Albert Borden Real Estate. And then... I wanted to get involved in politics again, and I got involved in Bob Kerry's campaign in 1992, and that led me to become the candidate up here for state senate. And that was the year that Clinton ran, and I was running as a Democrat in basically what was then a Republican district. And I was running against the Republican leader of the Senate, and I lost very narrowly. And then I ran again in 1994, because having come so close, I had to do it again.
Of course.
And, of course, 94 was the Gingrich zeitgeist, and no challenging Democrat to any sitting Republican anywhere in the country won. So, but I after that, I got involved in a lot of nonprofit organizations. At different times, I've been involved in the Northwest Connecticut AIDS Project. That's now part of a larger regional AIDS group based in Danbury. I served on the board of the Housatonic Valley Commission, the regional environmental concern. I was on the board for a while for the Women's Support Services early on, when it was in a little one-room office over in the Main Street in Falls Village. And then, most notably, though, I've been involved in Salisbury Family Services for many years. I was on the board for... I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years as sort of chairman of it. And along with Susan Knight, we've staged their biannual fundraisers for the last 12 years. And more recently, I've also been on the board of the Community Foundation of Northwest Connecticut, which is Torrington-based, but it is the umbrella philanthropic nonprofit organization for all the towns that we would recognize in these parts as Litchfield County. I also served for 6 years, one full term, and then half of the second term to which I was elected on planning and zoning. So that's a pretty good summary.
It certainly is.
Of all the stuff I've been involved in.
Is there anything that you'd like to add to this interview before we close?
Yeah, I think Salisbury's got a great, it's a wonderful, I'm a New Englander, so I was biased to enjoy a place like Salisbury. It is, I can't imagine a better place to live. The land is beautiful. The people in it are incredibly interesting. It really does have its share of characters.
Oh, yes.
Which makes it
That's what makes it interesting.
A marvelous place to be. It has a great history. I'm concerned that we've always had a tradition here of part-time residents, okay, because of the presence of the private schools. So people come and go.
Mm-hmm.
It was, people forget, a vacation spot, much less heralded than the Berkshires, but I mean, it was written.
Still important.
It was in the 1890s, turn of the century. It was written up, on goings-on, social events on Lakeville Lake were written up in the social pages of the New York newspapers. So we've always had that kind of tradition of it being a refuge for New Yorkers. After World War II, it did become a retirement destination for many people who were retired from the academic community, from the military, from intelligence services especially. So it's always been a place for part-time residents or weekenders. I would like everyone who comes to town, I would like to think that everyone who comes to town would have some appreciation of what went before them. Because it does really reflect on how they perceive other people and how they interact with people in who live here full time and who make investments into the community. It is very possible for part-time residents to make investments in the community. That is welcome. But mostly it informs land use.
Yes.
And there's a real pattern to how the land was developed up here that reflects not only the Congregationalist history of the town, but the way the town's lands were originally subdivided. And there's a sense of New England feng shui about where houses should be built so as to naturally accommodate light and the different seasons of the year and access to water. And in some of the new development, this has been completely ignored, and it is changing the face of the landscape in ways that I think offend the history. And I'm troubled by that, and I would encourage people to be appreciative and understand the land in which they now want to become part.
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
It's been fun.
It has been. So that's my soapbox.